This is Mary Franklin at 21 Abbey Road, Whitney, on the 18th of January, and I'm interviewing
Dr. Shanthini Cowley Sathyakumar.
Thank you very much. So, Shanthini, could you just tell me how you came to live in Whitney?
So my husband and I are both teachers. We know of Oxfordshire, but we've never lived in Oxfordshire before. We were living and working abroad for 8 years, which was wonderful, travelling the world. And then due to responsibilities with parents getting older and sort of coming back and wanting to sort of set up a bit of a base in the UK, we started looking at places to live back here. We decided we didn't want to live anywhere in the UK that we'd lived before, which was tricky because both of us have lived all over the place. And so I started applying for different positions. I also put my CV into a number of teaching agencies back in the UK. And out of the blue, one day in Portugal, I had an email come through. It came through to the school reception and then was forwarded to me. This is completely fluke because it may not have even got to the school, let alone to me. It was forwarded to me. And the deputy head teacher at Henry Box School had received my CV through one of the teaching agencies. And she said most of them are not particularly great, but she was really impressed. Like, she was just so surprised at my CV. I was deputy head pastoral at the time in Portugal, and she was really impressed with my CV. So she sent me through an email, and I interviewed online. Their head of faculty and school leader was leaving, and so I was then offered that position. And then Mark had interviewed previously for a position at a prep school near Abingdon. He hadn't got the job, but they then got back in touch with him because they loved him so much and offered him a position at the school, which was head of history, even though he's a geographer. But he took that because obviously he wanted a position as well. And so completely randomly, the two of us and our Brazilian rescue cat ended up in, first of all, Ensham, where we rented for a year. And then we bought a property in Whitney.
Okay.
It's like, so completely and utterly random, like completely random. There was no, it's very, very odd how things happen in life, isn't it? But I didn't know neither of us knew really anything about Whitney. I knew a bit about, my dad had lived many years ago in the 70s in Abingdon and he lived in Bicester. But other than that, not a clue. And here we are.
Clearly meant to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you arrived in Whitney,
yes.
from Portugal,
yes.
to Whitney. What were your first impressions of it?
Well, the thing is interesting because obviously we had to find somewhere to live. And so I'd done a lot of research. So Mark actually left Portugal in the summer holiday to start his teaching job in the September. I stayed back in Portugal for the summer with the cat. And then didn't start at Henry Box until that October half term. So I started looking around for places to live. And so I basically looked at the map and looked at what was halfway between his school and my school, which was Ensham. Knew nothing about it. Started looking for rental properties. Found a really cute little rental house in the heart of the village. Had no idea how lovely actually Ensham was going to be. Ended up, took it on without even seeing it or viewing it. Took on that property, loved Ensham. And then obviously Whitney, from where we were, was our sort of closest town. And actually really fell in love with Whitney as well. We'd lived in, obviously, 15 minutes from Lisbon. So where we lived was quiet, but the city was quite busy. We'd lived in Sao Paulo in Brazil, which is a mega city, so hugely busy. And Colombo in Sri Lanka, also crazy busy. So we wanted somewhere actually a little quiet for a quieter life. And Whitney seemed to offer that. And it was just wonderful because it offers all of the history that I love. Obviously it's countryside. I'm really horsey and I love the countryside, and Mark plays golf and he loves the countryside as well. We could get to Oxford, like we love restaurants and eating out, and actually like the diversity of Oxford as well. We can get to London. So yeah, it kind of just ticked all of the boxes. And as we were talking about earlier, the only thing it's missing is the sea, which would be the cherry on the top. But other than that, just lovely. And actually quite surprised by the people of Whitney, in the sense of when I joined the school, people actually were really, I was a little bit worried because it's very rural and you never know with a school where a lot of people have been at the school for a long time and how welcoming people are going to be. But on the whole, we generally felt very welcomed into Whitney as well. And I feel like now I can't walk down the street without seeing a student that I teach, or there's a link somewhere or something, which is actually really lovely. So yeah, it's really nice.
So one of the questions we ask everybody is whether you feel there's a sense of community. And I think you partly touched on that.
Yes, I think there is, but I worry a little that in recent times and recent years that might be shifting a little bit, but then I think that that's the same as what's happening in other parts of the country as well, that there are some divisions being created in the media by politicians politically, which means that, and I think that the population of Whitney, even in the 3 years I've been here, demographically the population is changing. I love it because I love the diversity. I love the fact that at school in my classroom I have 15 nationalities, 20 languages spoken. There's lots of Portuguese students at school. I've got a sixth former who's half French, half Brazilian. I love this because Mark and I are so international. For me, it's a pleasure. But I do think that possibly for people that have lived in Whitney all of generationally all their lives, who are maybe not so comfortable or haven't lived in that changing diversity of community, that I notice that perhaps there are some tensions arising around that. You only need to maybe have a quick look at Spotted Whitney occasionally when some of the posts go onto there, and the comments that happen as a result is interesting. I run the politics club at school, so we have debates every week. A lot of it is international politics, but obviously the students are drawn to talking about things. I definitely think there is a sense of community, and I feel personally very comfortable in Whitney, and I've very much enjoyed living here, but there are changes afoot. But I don't know whether that's necessarily just a Whitney thing. I actually think it is just a national thing and possibly a global thing, that divisions are being created, which will probably be undermining, unfortunately, a little bit of that community spirit.
Okay, thank you. So what then would your hopes be for the future of Whitney?
I think that it's difficult, isn't it? Because I think it takes a long time for people to shift and change. But I think I hope for people to embrace the changes and appreciate that society will inevitably change. I think it's important to hang on to and hold on to like the cultural and social roots of a place and a locality. I think that's really important. I find it very sad that in Whitney, obviously there's a blanket museum and some people talk about it and that, but I feel like that heart of Whitney, which was the factories and the industry and the people that worked in that industry, the fact that that is, I think, again, slowly eroding with younger generations not necessarily knowing about it and understand. I think that's sad. But at the same time, things will inevitably change too. So it's that challenge of how do you hold on to the heart of a locality or an area whilst at the same time embracing that change coming through? Because I think the change coming through is wonderful. I don't know. I think it's, I say, for me, I'm very, very internationally minded. I love that diversity and that difference. I think it's really important for human beings to be exposed to that and to see that, especially for our young people. It's really important that they see that, because that then hopefully brings about tolerance and compassion and sympathy, you know, and sympathy and empathy and all those sorts of things. But I think it's a challenge. I think it's a challenge. And that's tricky. And I think also with Whitney, it probably struggles a little bit of what we call brain drain, where the young people who are switched on and stay on for A-levels, probably a little bit like myself when I was growing up, want to get out of Whitney, sadly, and they leave. So they go to university and they go to those cities and they stay in those cities because it's exciting and fun. But it's whether or not they then come back and bring with them all of that wonderful open-mindedness, cosmopolitanism, all that stuff, and their skills and everything they've learned back to Whitney to make Whitney the amazing place it could still be, if that makes sense, or it could be in the future. And I think that's a challenge. It's like, how do we get people coming into Whitney who bring that breath of fresh air and like new ideas and that sort of thing? Because I feel like it's a place that, again, has so much potential, but there are challenges holding it back.
Do you worry it could stagnate?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. That's, again, a little bit like what we were talking about previously around when places sadly start to fall apart a little bit, and whether that is, you know, in the infrastructure of the place or, again, in people's, you know, beliefs and that kind of community spirit. It worries me a little. And what I found interesting, because obviously we're up on the Windrush development, and we do get on actually quite well with our neighbours, but everybody's so busy living their lives that you just, that sort of, that spirit around neighbours and getting to know each other is not as strong as I imagine it was maybe even 20 years ago in a place like Witney, because it is a relatively small community. So, yeah.
And do you think that is because of the way life is lived now, or is it partly because of the rate Witney has developed?
I think it's a combination of both. I think people's lives have changed, that now we have a situation where, you know, probably, and I'm not saying, you know, I'm very much a feminist myself, so I believe in that women should have the independence to work and all of those things. So for me, it doesn't matter who's at home. It doesn't matter. But I wonder whether, because parents are so busy working, life is now very transient and changing, and that is one aspect of it, so that that's tricky, because that core of the family maybe doesn't exist as it did previously. But yeah, it's a difficult one to pinpoint exactly what it is and how you shift it, because I don't think maybe the local government is necessarily, or governance is helping as much as they could be, shall we say. Because there's also an element of, like, you want an element of pride in the place that you live too. And if you feel like it's covered in potholes and that the roads are not being appropriately cleaned and kept tidy, or if you live on a new housing development and that's not being looked after appropriately, even though it should be. It's like, I know these are really small things, but I think all of this also feeds into, yeah, how we create a town and a place where people feel proud of it, but not pride in a really misplaced, nationalistic, odd sense. More of a pride because of what the potential that the place could be, I think.
Yeah,
it's a really, because I'm a sociologist as well as a historian, so I spend my whole time analysing these things and just thinking about what could we do on a societal level as well as individual level to make things better. I do have some ideas, but unfortunately I'm not in the local council or in local governance to make that difference at the moment. So, but I also imagine there's resistance, because I get the impression that a lot of people, inevitably, again, in the local council and in governance in Witney, also possibly don't have enough experience outside of the local area or even Oxfordshire to be able, again, to bring in, like, fresh ideas and understanding of other places that have changed and shifted and how they managed it. And then, like, can we learn from those ideas in the place that we're in? And I just, yeah, I wonder whether there's obstacles there as well.
Okay. Let's move on to the school and your role there. I noticed in your email there's about three lines to describe your role.
Yeah.
So could you expand on
yes.
that,
yes. So I am, it's an interesting, like, the management structure at Henry Box is quite different actually to a lot of schools that I've worked in. So there's a head teacher, deputy head teacher, and then there are a number of school leaders. So the school leaders are either academic heads of faculty or house leaders, so pastoral leaders within the school. And then there is a head of learner engagement as well, who is sort of, I guess, would be traditionally deputy head pastoral. So I am the head of faculty for social science, so history, geography, RS psychology, sociology come under my remit. And then alongside that, I have whole school responsibilities for anti-bullying and for higher prior attaining students. So students who traditionally would have been known as gifted and talented. So those that have either something, you know, a talent, musical, sporty, or are particularly strong in an academic subject, in order to provide them with opportunities to succeed. So yes.
And then you have your actual teaching.
Yes, and then I taught a number of different year groups within the school, but currently I teach sociology A level year 12 and 13, and I have a history year 11 GCSE class, but I have taught from Key Stage 3, so year 7, basically I've taught at the school year 7 all the way through to year 13, but at the moment it's, and I run the sociology A level at the school, and we don't technically have a head of history, so we have sort of subject leads. I have a subject lead for geography, RS and psychology, but then as I'm also a historian, I sort of head up history as well with the other history teachers. So there's a lot of hats and I'm very busy.
And you taught, you know, all around the world,
yes,
presumably in the different places that, yeah, you lived. So how does Henry Box, you know, what are the sort of commonalities, but what are the differences as well?
I think that teenagers are teenagers everywhere in the world, genuinely. And I think this is it's actually interesting. It comes back to what, when we were talking about, you know, trying to promote community spirit and, you know, people divisions and those sorts of things, is that ultimately human beings are human beings. We have good human beings, we have bad human beings, you know, whatever that means, but and everything in between. And I think it's the same for the teenagers that I've taught. Just because they speak different languages, or they might eat different foods, or their experience, you know, their wealth levels are different, they are generally the same. I was very much looking forward to coming back to teach in the UK, because British teenagers do have a very unique sense of humour, which I really enjoy. And that's not to say, don't get me wrong, I loved my young people that I taught elsewhere in the world, but they do have a sense of humour which you don't necessarily find. But I was quite surprised because, and again, obviously backdrop of the pandemic, coming back into the UK to teach, I found, and I genuinely don't think this is a Henry Box or an Oxfordshire school thing, having spoken to other teachers in the UK, is that some of the students lost a bit of their spark, I think, because of their experience of the pandemic at whatever age group they were. And it's taken me a good two and a half years that I've been here to get my classes to where I expected them to be in terms of like confidence, self-esteem, charisma, that kind of thing. But actually, but it is shifting, and even in the school as a whole, you can tell it's starting to go back to normal, like pre-pandemic conditions, if that makes sense. So that was quite a shock to the system, coming back to the UK and expecting the young people to be a certain way. And I've also taught all over the UK as well. So again, there's not a lot of differences between teenagers, I would say, wealth levels, those sorts of things, but they're very similar. So that was quite a surprise. That was a surprise. Mm-hmm. But I just kind of, I think every school I've taught in, you go with an open mind, you see, you know, what the young people are like in front of you, and you deal with them as you find them, really. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can ever have preconceptions of teenagers. I think that's a very dangerous thing. And actually, I have to say, I was really, really pleasantly surprised by how open-minded and compassionate and tolerant the vast majority of our young people are. When you talk to them about issues facing the UK, international issues, poverty, you know, the whole, anything really, you talk to them about those issues. I did think, because it was Whitney and rural edge of Cotswolds, that there might be a very set perspective on things. But actually, it's not like that. Particularly the A-level students are probably amongst some of the most open-minded and switched on, in some ways, not all, but in some ways, young people that I have taught, in the sense of they're very open to knowing about, they want to know about the world outside Whitney, and they get very excited about it, because probably a lot of them haven't necessarily travelled that much, some have, and they haven't gone that far, and so they're super excited, and they remind me of me when I was that age, in that I just wanted to know everything from my teachers and find out everything about the world and what was going on. And so they are that way, but it's taking time. I think the pandemic has really impacted them, and they're now starting to build the confidence to ask the questions that I want them to ask, and to engage me with me in a way that is not just academic teaching, but also shaping them as young people.
Yes.
I think.
Oh, well, that is really encouraging and heartening.
Yeah, it is.
To hear.
Yeah, it is. I think we're very negative about young people all the time, and I think that the media, you know, again, people put young people down all the time, but actually, they're not all wonderful all of the time, but a lot of them are really wonderful and they're going to go on to be really successful. I don't mean that necessarily financially successful, but they're going to contribute, I really do think, a lot to society. And I wouldn't do the job if I didn't think that there was a positive outcome for at least most of them, I hope.
Mm. You touched earlier on the mix of students in the school, in your classes. Mm. Could you say a little bit more about that and what that means for the class and for you as a teacher?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, as I say, I love it. I think it's amazing. We have students from all over the world, even my tutor group. It is interesting because all the school leaders at Henry Box have a tutor group. So not some schools, if you're in school leadership, you don't have a tutor group. That's one thing you don't have. But we all have a tutor group, so my tutor group. Even my tutor group is a mix. Of, as I say, ethnicity, nationality, the number of languages that are spoken. Obviously, as I say, on the one hand, on a really positive level, it is wonderful because you have young people who bring experiences from all over the world. Some of them are first generation, second generation, third generation, which is great. But equally, at the same time, that can also be challenging when you have students who do have English as an additional language, because obviously, ultimately, we want to get them through GCSEs, and sometimes, you know, if they're going on to A levels, to get them good results, which can be hard, which can be challenging. And I think it, interestingly, I'd say in a lot of cases, the students that are coming from abroad and different parts of the world often actually are incredibly hardworking, because their parents, for whatever reason, and we do have a number of young people that are in Whitney and at the school, because of very challenging circumstances back in their home country. So war, natural disaster, you know, we have, that's the reality of what we are dealing with. But for the most part, those children and those families, they want them to have a really good education. They're very supportive. And sometimes actually it's the young people who maybe whose families have been in Whitney for a long time. It's not all by any means, but sometimes those can be sometimes the situations where there's a little bit of complacency around education, whereas for those young people that are coming from backgrounds where life has been very hard, education is really important because that's their means to their future, and their parents want them to work hard to get good results, probably go on to higher education and university, and those sorts of things. But again, it's that shift and that transition. I think schools replicate society as a whole, and there are challenges when you have students from varying backgrounds, without a doubt, and I've taught in a lot of schools where that's been the case. But I think the challenge for us in Whitney is because we are very early stages of that journey. If we look at parts of London and Birmingham and Leeds and Manchester, where that diversity has been there already for maybe the last 200 years, we are very, very early on that journey, and navigating that can be tricky because, as I say, I think for some, and it really, it, I say, I genuinely think it is quite a small percentage, because we have a lot of students who are very open-minded, have friends from all different backgrounds, and are very, very, you know, happy to, and embrace it totally. Mm-hmm. But for some, I think it's a little tricky. And we know with young people, they take on board a lot of what they hear and what their parents are saying mm-hmm. from home. Mm-hmm. But we just have to, I think the important thing for us as a school is we just have to keep telling and saying and pushing the message that, you know, it's happening, and we learn the ways to navigate this together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important, and that us as teachers and as a school can support our students and our families through that. Yeah, I think is important. But I say, because I taught abroad, and teaching in Sri Lanka was a little bit different, because a lot of Sri Lankan students speak English. It's the language, because of the Tamil and the Sinhalese, English is the joining language, so it's most of them. But in Brazil particularly, a lot of the students, their English was fluent. Some of them spoke three or four languages, but they spoke a lot of Portuguese at school. So I'm quite used to being in a classroom where all of my students are speaking and I don't understand what they're saying. But they're doing an English curriculum, obviously. Yes. And it's interesting because I would teach them in English, and then they would discuss an activity or the work in Portuguese, and then they would come back and feedback to me in English. And you just navigate it. So I think, again, I'm probably in a very unique position to have experienced that, because most British teachers or UK-based will never have experienced a classroom that is bilingual or even more, you know, have never experienced that or even the diversity of it in an international school. You do have students coming from all over the world. That's the nature of it. So, yeah. And as I said, I think if teachers have taught, and I've taught in London, I've taught in Birmingham, I've taught in multiple places in the UK, if you teach in schools where diversity has been there for a long time, it's just accepted. It's just part of, it's normal, it's normalised. Mm. Whereas I think those pockets of the UK where that hasn't been the case and it is changing, it is. But we really are working hard, and I think there's a real drive to help those children and families, those that are coming into the school, but also those that are already existing there, to try and navigate some of these challenges and to help them with it. Sometimes to help the young people with the language that they use, because sometimes I don't even realise what they're saying is not appropriate. Yeah. And it's, if you don't teach them and help them to understand, there's no point in getting angry and with them. We have to help them. And then actually, once, you know, again, 9 times out of 10, when you explain to them, this is why you shouldn't say that term or that phrase, or, and they're like, oh, I had no idea. It's like adults, isn't it? Adults don't really understand.
Do you think you've got that sort of anti-bullying, probably sort of anti-racism?
It's part of it, yes.
Of your job. Mm. Do you think having that sort of cosmopolitan makeup in the classes, is that help? Does that help in a way to erode those attitudes, or is the reverse true?
No, I think it's definitely, as I said before, I think the challenge is the pace at which it's happening. I think that's the thing. I think that if over the next 20 years there was a very gradual shift in the demographic of Whitney and the schools, and I think this is not just a Henry Box thing, this is if there was a slow shift and gradual change, I think people wouldn't necessarily even notice it, because it would just happen. But because it's happening very quickly because of national and global politics and what's happening in the wider world, I think that's where the difficulty is. And I think that's what young people are finding hard to work through. Because up until, you know, a certain point, the classroom looked a certain way and sounded a certain way, and now it's changing. And I think that, but again, I think that that's a, I think that's something that probably every school and every society has always struggled with, and you will always have the people that are naturally more open-minded and more welcoming and more inclusive, and you will have people who are a little bit more anxious and just scared. I think it's just fear. A lot of it is just fear of the unknown, and people, human beings are very scared of what they don't know. And if you can get past that, then it's fine, isn't it? Because you, once you realise that that scary thing is not scary anymore, it's absolutely fine. So I think the other issue, I do think social media has not helped with this either. Because obviously there are a lot of messages and a lot of influences coming from outside of the home and also school now. So a lot of that is tricky too, because you're now, you're battling not only sometimes maybe prejudices that are held within a community, prejudices that might be held within generationally within a family. It's now prejudices which are being actively promoted, and they are seeing every single day on social media. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that's the biggest challenge around trying to help them to understand what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, what you should say, what you shouldn't say, how you should approach certain social situations. Yeah, I think that's the, I think that's probably the trickier one, because it's that difficulty of what are they being exposed to that we have no control over, and their parents have no control over too. That I think, and some of the, you know, the racism and the misogyny that we know is becoming challenging, and a lot of this sort of subculture stuff that some of our young people, not, I say I'm talking just nationally, I think globally, that our young people are facing, is very difficult to monitor and police, because we're not exposed to it. They're seeing it themselves.
Do you think the answer is to ban social media for under 16?
It's a huge debate, isn't it? I'm on the fence. I think it's really hard. I think it's, and I know a number of schools are going with it. I think it's really tricky because I think we are, it's really important that we teach young people how to manage their time and the use of social media, because they are going into, they're not going anywhere. Phones, social, it's not going, it's not disappearing. So we have to help them to learn how to navigate that world appropriately and well. So I'm always, it worries me when we just go, we're going to stop something completely, because I don't think it fixes the problem.
No.
Because even if you ban them in school, they will still be on them for, it might increase how much time they're on them after school and in the evenings. But at the same time, it would also be, I have to say, like, don't get me wrong, we do, because we obviously they're mobile, they have their mobile phones, but if we see them and they're in, it's in lessons or in school time without permission from a teacher, it's confiscated. So we are pretty strict on that. And my experience is that in, and I go into a lot of lessons and everything, and actually I think it's very good actually in our school, in that sense. But I think we have to have a cultural shift around, just in general, around how we are preparing, dare I say, training our young people how to use social media. Because actually, I teach a lot of young people who are really good, who are able to manage, have a lot of, they're self-disciplined, basically, and they're very good at being able to navigate things and know how to use it well, and how not, and how they shouldn't be, and those sorts of things. But that doesn't apply to everybody, but... So I think also the internet is a wonderful tool because you can, if you use it appropriately in teaching, if I'm teaching global development, I want my young people to understand about another country in another part of the world. What an amazing thing it is now that they can access those things, which I didn't have when I was at school. I had to go, there's nothing, I love the library and it's great, amazing. But I had to go to a book, and that book was probably 10 years out of date, and the pictures I was seeing were not, whereas now they can actually access so much, which is wonderful. So I'm very, I try to take a pragmatic and sensible approach to these things. And I try to think of it from the perspective of an adult and a teacher, but also from the perspective of a young person and navigating that world for them. How do we help them to do that well? Because they have to.
Yeah.
They have to. So, but yeah, that's that. I think that's the worry, is what they are accessing, what they're seeing, what they're being told and influenced by, which is out of our remit and out of our control, I think is tricky. And I say, like we were talking about at the beginning, parents being increasingly more busy, lives are more transient. I get it. They're not able to monitor as much as they probably would like. And I'm often quite shocked when you tell them how many hours their child has been on a mobile phone each day, potentially what they've been looking at, what they've been doing. Genuinely often, like, you know, really, really supportive parents are shocked by what they... But I think they're also trying to work out this crazy world. Things have changed so much in the last, even like the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's mad, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're a teacher of history. Would I be right in thinking that the curriculum is still quite British history focused?
We're very lucky at Henry Box, in that there's been a process of what we call decolonising the curriculum. So there's been, and again, coming back into the UK, that was really interesting, actually. We left the UK in 2016. And so coming back almost a decade later, I was really intrigued as to what the curriculum would look like, what had changed, what had shifted. I was very fortunate. I did my teacher training, my PGC at Cambridge, and my PGC tutor, even back in sort of 2010, 2011, was already talking about diverse histories, how do we make the history curriculum more inclusive, all of those sorts of things. So, and I think obviously myself being mixed race, I've always also been very aware of the fact that traditionally and historically, we've always taught a certain curriculum. So I think at Henry Box, I genuinely think, and we are consistently shifting. There was a conversation the other day, actually, with the Year 7 curriculum. There's a unit on the Crusades. And obviously, historically and traditionally, a lot of it has always been taught from kind of an English-British perspective. Last week, somebody was coming in to work on actually how we can update that curriculum to talk about it from an Islamic perspective. So how can we teach the Crusades from the perspective of the people that actually were being, let's be honest, being invaded effectively, and something being imposed upon them from their perspective. We teach in year eight, we have, when we do empires, we have a sequence of lessons all about the Ghanaian Empire, and looking at how that, the history of that has largely been lost, but the fact that it was incredibly significant within the African continent. And so there's definitely, without a doubt, I can only really speak for Henry Box, because having come back to the UK, I haven't taught in any other UK schools since being here. But I know I'm very lucky to have a history department which is actually very switched on about those sorts of things. And yes, we are very conscious of making sure that we don't just teach one worldview. When I teach global development at A level, I very much teach it from an international perspective. I'm trying to help the students to understand that, you know, if we're looking at what we consider to be the developing world, actually, is that appropriate to call it that? And all those, so we're working really hard to do that. Do I think that's happening in other UK schools to the same extent? Probably not. I think within a lot of state schools, there's a shift in that direction. I do think that within the independent sector, there's probably still very much a focus on British history.
A more traditional curriculum.
Yeah. I think so, without a doubt. Again, just because of the nature, it's all to do with in the diversity of that school, the teachers within that school, what those teachers have experienced and been exposed to. I think that all has an impact. Yeah.
And what about the students? How, because lower down the school, it's a core subject, and students haven't chosen that subject. Obviously, once they get into GCSEs and A levels, it's more of a choice. So how do you keep all of your students motivated and want, you know, if you can? Can you get them motivated and interested?
I think I'm very, I mean, I know we're all biased, but I think I'm very, I am very lucky at Henry Box. I do have a great, we've employed a new history teacher from September. She's an archaeologist actually by trade. So she's kind of new, older, but new into the profession. So very keen, very passionate and interested and excited. I have another teacher who is probably 3 years into her career, but also that's really interesting because she's also bringing lots of, like, we had the Historical Association debate this week. So we had students come from other schools to debate each other. And so, I also have another teacher who is actually a school leader and in charge of teaching and learning, and also an amazing, great teacher who's teaching a little bit of sociology with me as well. So I'm very fortunate that I have a history department who I think are extremely passionate about their subject. We have an exciting, an up-to-date curriculum, which we hope keeps, you know, students engaged and interested. We currently have just shy of 90 doing GCSE at history. So we have three pretty much full classes, which is amazing. So that's, you know, that's wonderful. So I think that for me, the key with this is obviously teaching really good history, setting them up with all the skills that they need to be successful in the subject and other subjects as well. But it's just being passionate about your subject and loving it, mm-hmm. and just really enjoying it. And then if the students know you're passionate about it and you love it, then they come along for the ride. It is. And you're always going to have a few who, for whatever reason, and sometimes actually what I think is quite interesting is sometimes it's not because they don't enjoy history and they don't enjoy the teaching. They actually just find what they need to do in history to be successful, challenging and hard. So the extended writing, the analysis, they find that genuinely difficult. And so that is hard because then it sometimes prevents them from accessing the curriculum and enjoying the subject because they feel like they can't be successful in it. And so it's how do we overcome those barriers as well, and how do we support those young people to love it and enjoy it. But I'm very fortunate. Our social science faculty is a very strong faculty. We have we have amazing teachers. And within history as well, like, we really do try to do everything we can to bring it to life, I think.
Mm-hmm. So how did you become passionate about history? And did you always want to be a teacher?
Yeah, so my mum is a really, really, I'd say she's a historian, actually. Like, she just is so amazingly passionate about history. And so from as early as I can remember, she's just loved it. And I think if she had had the same opportunities, maybe if she'd been born 20 or 30 years later and had the opportunities to, I know she would have gone down a historical career without a doubt, whatever that, maybe not teaching, but I just know that I would have been. It's absolutely her passion. So I grew up with, you know, hundreds of history books in the house, being taken to museums and castles and just everything around that. My dad just got kind of swept along through it, so I got taken with it as well. Always watching like history TV. I just everything about it. I had amazing history teaching at school. I loved my history teacher, and that I was very fortunate to have my teacher from year 7 to year 11, and then she taught me for A-level sociology. So I enjoyed it. It was my favourite subject at school. I loved it. And then I did A-level, and I grew up in Hastings, which I was born in Bath, but grew up in Hastings, and Hastings is just everywhere you look, there's history, everything about it. I just love that. It was just a part of everything, really. And I just enjoyed, for me, history. I think the thing is, like, some historians or people who love, are interested in history or love history, it's very much kind of an academic subject, and it is, but for me, it's about the stories and the people. And I remember, like, Mum always, so my love of the Tudors and my specialism in the Tudors comes from my mum's just absolutely encyclopedia knowledge of royalty and the royal families. And just, it's just amazing. And she's really also into genealogy. So she's got, but pretty much on her side, Sri Lankan with my dad's a bit difficult, but on hers, we've got back to about the 1100s, which is just extraordinary. And I am, my 13th great-grandfather was basically the brother of Thomas Cranmer. So I know, like, it's just, I just love everything. It's just everything about it, I find exciting. And then, interestingly, I didn't do history as a degree. I did political science and international studies because I knew I wanted to, at some point, live and work abroad. I then fell into, slightly randomly, my first master's and my PhD. And that was in sociology. And my academic specialism is ethnicity and identity and race and those sorts of things. And I did all about Sri Lanka and about the war and the conflict and looked at migration in that capacity. Then went on and then decided just, like, I think I probably felt I was always going to go into teaching. I really wanted to have a career in the Foreign Office. That was what I wanted to do, either Foreign Office or politics. Just, I think, because of my PhD, I ended up not going down that route. Finished my PhD, took on a position down in Brighton, actually, as a researcher. That fell through. And I was like, what am I going to do? So at that point, I was a little bit older. So my dad was like, do you want to try history now, teaching and stuff? And I thought, okay, we'll give it a go. So that's when I went back to do my PGCE. So I was about 28 doing that, 29. Did my PGCE, then decided that I wanted to do another master's, so did an MA in education, and did that whilst in my first year of teaching in London, in a city school in London. That's where I met my husband. And then decided that we kind of do, I think it was 3 years we did. We moved to a school on the outskirts, in Bexley Heath, on the outskirts of London. We did 3 years there, and then I took on the head of sociology there as well as a history teaching. And then that's when we decided, you know what, we want to go and live and travel and see the world, really, and went from there. So, yeah, I haven't quite given up on the idea of a political career. I know I'm getting a little older now, but it's always in the back of my mind whether that might be something to think about in the future. Because don't get me wrong, I absolutely love teaching. I just love it. It's one of those things that I'm not a particularly, like, I'm quite modest about things, but I know I'm good at it. And I know that I have a good relationship. Like, I just know I just love it. I can do it without even thinking about it, and I love it. But there's part of me that would like to take all of my experience and skills and possibly put into a different context at some point. We'll see. I wanted to be a vet originally, but my sciences and my maths weren't good enough. So unfortunately, I went down. But I've wanted to be lots of things over the years. And I don't know. I've let life take me to different places. I think I've lived in about 30 different houses. I've lived all over the country. And I've loved every minute of it. And I wouldn't have changed it for the world. So I think that's what's interesting when we talk about a place like Whitney, which has such amazing history to it. But people that have lived here their whole life, that is quite an alien concept to me. because I've worked and lived and travelled so much. Mm-hmm. I find, but equally, I never judge. Because, you know, who am I to say that somebody who's lived in Whitney their whole life, maybe they wanted to, maybe they didn't, but that's entirely their choice. Whereas my life is my choice, and I would never make a judgment on somebody. And I really hope people don't make a judgment on on mine and my husband's choice to do what we've done. I think most people look at it and think, oh, that's really exciting. And I'm always like, but you can, like, to my students, like, if you want to do it, you go and do it. There's nothing, I always think in life, there's nothing stopping you. If you want something badly enough, you can get it if you want it.
So, you know, your students are going through the school system. I don't know about you, but I think most of us remember some of our teachers. Maybe not all of them, but some of them. So what do you think your students are going to remember about you?
I hope they remember is that, yeah, I loved my subjects. I was enthusiastic. I also hope as well that they think that I helped them to understand the world a little better. I think that's the thing, like how you approach, as I say, like the curriculum, the history curriculum, the sociology curriculum, the geography curriculum, all of those things are extremely important. And I want our young people to learn all of the skills that go alongside that, how to write an amazing essay, how to, you know, public speak, all those things are amazing. And I want them to know the content of the history that we're teaching them. But I also want them to have the skills to be critical thinkers, independent thinkers, look at an issue in society or within history and be able to engage with that in a way that is not just seeing the world through one lens or one way. That for me is really important. It's like if there's an event happening somewhere in the world or even something that's happened 100 years ago, whatever it might be, the French Revolution, Battle of Hastings, whatever it is, for them to look at that and not go, oh, there's only one perspective or interpretation of this, to be able to look at it and go, oh, okay, so at the Battle of Hastings, what would have been the interpretation of William, of what happened around being promised the throne? What was the interpretation of Harold? And why did maybe misinterpretations between all of them lead to what happened and effectively changing maybe, you know, not just UK history, but international history, arguably, forever? And that for me is the key, is like I want them to be, and I think I was really fortunate to have parents that brought me up to see the world that way, and also some teachers, not all, but some teachers who helped me to see the world in a different, actually I messaged my old head teacher this morning. He lives in France now, he's off to South Africa for a couple of weeks because I just want some tips on a holiday. But I'm still in touch with my head, I'm still in touch with my head of year, I'm still in touch with one of my old teachers lives down in Gloucestershire. I met up with her a year ago. So I still maintain connections and with a lot of my teachers, and I hope, and I do with a lot of my students as well, not all. So I hope that they will remember me in fondly, but I hope that they remember that I was that teacher that helped them to go beyond the curriculum and shape them in as human beings, shall we say, rather than just coming into a classroom, us doing a lesson and then them leave again. I want them to come out with more than that, I think. And I think that's what my dad always said that as well as a teacher. He retired 20 years ago, but he's still in touch with lots of his students and they keep him updated on what they're up to. And so I probably have followed my dad's model of teaching in lots of ways, in the relationships and, you know, that he formed over the years with his colleagues and his students, because teaching is all about, it's like history, isn't it? It's all about human interaction, human relationships. And I wouldn't, the thought of just going to school each morning and going into a classroom and delivering something without any kind of interaction, or I couldn't imagine it. It would be so sad. Yeah, three of my A-level students have gone off to university last year. They wanted to meet up. Obviously, I wasn't well at Christmas. They wanted to meet up to tell me how they're getting on and everything. So for me, I think those connections, I think are really important. And I say, I hope that some of them maintain those connections because they remember our conversations and, you know, our laughing and joking, but also the world that I could tell them about, I think.
Brilliant. And, you know, you've travelled really widely and done all sorts of different things. What might tempt you to stay in Whitney for a bit longer?
Well, I think that, obviously, as we spoke about, my mum and dad wanting to move to be closer to my husband and I, as an only child, you know, and I'm very, very close to my mum and dad, and they were wonderful to me growing up. Like, genuinely, I couldn't have asked for better parents and a better child. It was amazing. And so it's kind of now my time to sort of role reversal, isn't it? You get to a point amazingly, you never think it's going to come, but it is that. So I think that they're just, and Dad keeps saying to me, he's like, are you staying in Whitney? Are you staying, you're going to be there? And I'm like, well, I don't know, because I don't think, there's nothing that's like, I really enjoy it here. I think the only thing that would potentially take us away from Whitney would be, like professionally, if an opportunity came up for either Mark or myself. You know, I'm in no hurry to leave Whitney or to leave the school actually in any way. But equally, if an amazing opportunity were, I would quite like to be a deputy head again. There's things within my career, even if it isn't outside of teaching, but there's things even within my teaching career that I still want to do. Mark's the same. I think both of us get itchy feet and we get bored quite easily. Like in the sense of, don't get me wrong, I like a quiet life now, but for both of us intellectually, like we like to be challenged. Mm-hmm. I really thrive on it. And if I feel at any point that I'm getting where I feel like I've contributed everything I can, and or I feel like I'm not myself being fulfilled in some way from my job and my career, then that's sometimes the point. And again, I got that very much came from my dad. He was always like, you know, you can't just flit around, but equally you, and obviously there's responsibilities and things happen which makes that more difficult. But yes, so I'm very happy here. Mark's very happy here. I think my mum and dad would really enjoy living here as well. And so we want to be here, but it's all about whether or not, and the thing is within education in Oxfordshire, that's a tricky one too, because we're not within a city where there's lots of options.
Yes.
So that's also the thing as well. People here are comfortable, so they don't move anywhere. Because it's really nice. So they don't go anywhere. So you haven't got opportunities arising. And I say, Mark and I have always alternated. When in Portugal I was deputy head, he was an assistant head. Prior to that, he was head of subjects. I wasn't the head. So we very much, you know, we're very understanding of each other's careers, and so we're very supportive. If it means that I take a back step for him, that happens. If he does the same, so it's, we're very, very, you know, flexible with that. But yeah, just depends what opportunities. And I say, I think in the current economic climate, a lot of teachers are not moving anywhere. Mm-hmm. They're staying put. Mm-hmm. Which I get and I understand. Yeah. Yeah. But that does then make it quite tricky if you do reach a point that you want to move on professionally. If there's not openings for that, that can be hard. Mm. So I wouldn't rule. Do I think that we will stay in Whitney for the rest of our lives? No. I think once we get to a point in our life where we don't have any responsibilities, hopefully we will definitely go back and live abroad. Mm-hmm. I would go tomorrow if I was in a position to, because I enjoyed it and loved it so much. And I'm very happy here in Whitney, but my Facebook memories keep throwing up photographs of sunshine and holidays and friends and experiences from away that, yeah, it's, it will, that draw will always, I think, will always be there. There's that little bit. It's better in the summer. I feel less. But in it, this time of year, I think both of us find it quite hard.
Do you think that's partly because, you know, you've got those experiences behind you, or do you think it's in part driven by your mixed race? Is there a sort of pull there as well to another culture?
I think a little bit. I think the thing is, obviously being born, I was born in the UK. I grew up here for all of my, you know, I've apart from my 2 years in Sri Lanka teaching, I didn't live in Sri Lanka as a child. Dad came to the UK in 1969. He's been in the UK longer than Sri Lanka. So I think there's always that element of, and he's Sri Lankan Tamil, so he's from the north. And where he grew up was hugely affected by the war and the conflict. He lost his father, so I never knew my grandfather because he was shot and killed in the troubles and the problems. And it was when Mark and I lived in Sri Lanka, Mum and Dad came out to see us, and it had been the first time he'd been back to his village for 36 years. And he actually went, the first time he'd been to his dad's grave, and we went to the house. And that was quite a cathartic experience for him and me, really, to go, you know, to do that together. So I think I've always grown up with a sense of that I have that other culture. But this is what I find so interesting, you know, with everything that's going on at the moment, this idea of like what it is to be British. I think for me, that's such a fluid thing. Like, it's so fluid. Don't get, you know, Mark and I got married in 2012, and we got married the day after the opening ceremony for the London Olympics. And we went to the Olympics the week after our wedding for some of the events. And we were like, this is like the best of what it is to be British. Like, it was just an amazing summer. It was so wonderful. We had two other weddings. It was amazing because this is what it's about: multiculturalism, diversity, people coming together, people not thinking about the colour of people's skin or where they come from or anything. It's just people coming together in this wonderful melting pot, which is Britain and the UK. And then everything sort of went wrong after that, sadly. And it has. It's since the sort of referendum and everything, everything's sort of fallen apart a little bit. But that's what I love. Part of what I love about being British is also that sense of the fact that includes, like, you know, the majority of my dad's family are either in the UK or Australia or Germany. You know, there's very few people left in Sri Lanka anymore. But it's definitely part, and it's definitely a draw. I think I was definitely born to grow up in a hot country, without a doubt. There's something about it that I just love. And thankfully I found a husband who is a lot paler than me, but loves the sunshine too and enjoys it. But I think, and oddly for Mark, obviously, he grew up with such a different background and very limited travel when he's younger. His parents have only ever been abroad once in their entire life, like very different. But he was just itching to go, and I guess we kind of found each other and we could go and do that adventure together. So I think it's a combination. I think I always had a desire and a drive to explore and see the world. I think my parents encouraged that within me. I always remember what I love conservation and wildlife as well. I always remember watching David Attenborough documentaries and going, like, I want to go to Borneo to go and see the orangutans. I want to go to the Maldives to go and see wildlife. You know, all of these, which we have now done, which is extraordinary, but my list is not finished and it's not ended. And so there's so many more places that I want to explore. But I think Dad being, I guess, an immigrant and, you know, travelling at the age he did, he went to a country completely unknown from scratch. Before social media and all of those things, it was letters home every 6 weeks. And he did that. And I just think, like, how brave is that to do something like that? I think that's why I'm so understanding to people's experiences, because my dad did it. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit emotional. It's like, yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah, talking, it's just, yeah. It's
interesting.
Oh, thank you. Sorry. I didn't think I'd get emotional. Thank you. But it's interesting talking about it. I think as I got older, I think when I was younger, when you're younger, you don't think about it as much. And I think as you get older, you sort of, yeah, you reflect on it more. And I think, especially with what is going on at the moment, I think I find that quite sad.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. No, it's fine. No, it's fine. Honestly, I don't mind. I think, no, it's fine. I think because I teach subjects where we talk about it all the time.
Yes.
And I think that, and I think because I am so politically aware, and sometimes that can be, it's an amazing thing, but it's also a negative thing because you're so constantly conscious of what's going on. And I say I'm very lucky that in my day to day, I'm with people who I say I think are very open-minded and lovely and tolerant and all those things. But, yeah, things worry me, the way things are going.
Yes, so you're looking at all of that and thinking about it, but then in your role, you also have a responsibility to help your students navigate it.
Yeah, so it's like, and I can't get upset, and it's really hard. Like, not that I can't get upset, don't get me wrong, I have cried before when I've taught the Holocaust and different bits and pieces, and I have no problem with that. I'm happy to get emotional in front of the students. But that can be difficult because you're teaching histories which... It's weird, isn't it? Like I was saying I'm doing the Cold War at the moment with Year 11, and so we're talking about obviously the clash of ideology between capitalism and communism, and obviously in Year 9 we do Nazi Germany, and I've taught at IB the establishment of authoritarian states, and like we're living through it, and I think that's what's hard, and I think and actually like you have to maintain, you know, a very impartial, stoic kind of historical approach to these things and teach them in that way, but that can be hard because you just think about what world are we creating for all of these young people that they're going into, and that's horrible to think that maybe they won't have the opportunity to travel like I have, and they won't have the opportunity to meet people from all parts of the world, because maybe that world is closing in a little bit at the moment, sadly. And you know, we know it always swings. It's always swung right and left, and it will continue to. But it does, yeah. It scares me a little. Yeah, it does scare me a little.
But hopefully, there'll be some young people coming through Henry Box,
and there always will.
Who will have the opportunity to challenge and question?
And there always will be. And this is why we always have to say, I do stay eternally optimistic, because you have to.
Yeah.
Because and actually, it will be okay. There'll be a lot of damage done in the process, but it will sort itself out again. But we're just living through a period of history which you hope that you never live through. I think that's the thing. Mm. And a lot of people don't necessarily have to live through that, but we are. And that's, and I think, again, because I'm acutely aware of it from so many different angles and perspectives, that can be, yeah, that can be tricky. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you.
That's okay.
Is there anything else you want to add, particularly around sort of Whitney or the school?
I just think that I think we talked about before, I think there's so much potential, and I think it's like anything in life, you really hope that human beings, like, we can make those positive changes, whatever that is. But I'm also aware as well that my perspective and how I see the world isn't necessarily right. Equally, like, it's just because I see the world in one way, that's the way that I've been socialized and brought up, and that always, your experience always feed everything, don't they? And but maybe that's not the right way, and maybe there's other ways that things should be done. And I think that's part of it. I say with Whitney, I think, having grown up in Hastings, where I feel eternally frustrated that the history of that area is not shown and promoted and, yeah, like, just, you know, embrace as much as it should be, I feel like Whitney's the same. I feel like we're sitting on a gold mine here of this amazing, extraordinary history of a small locality. Especially, like I remember when I first went into the Blanket Museum, I was just wandering around and I was seeing all the pictures of, like, obviously, like, the fact that the blankets went out to the Indigenous tribes and groups in you know, in America and the States and the Hudson Bay. And so randomly at half term, we met, when we were in Cuba in a bar, we met a Canadian couple. Robin is American, actually. She grew up in Brooklyn, but her husband is Canadian. She's lived in Canada for years. And we just got chatting about politics, and we chatted for about 10 minutes and then had to go to dinner. And we decided to stay in touch on Facebook, and they live on Vancouver Island. And 2 summers ago, we went out to see them. Everybody thought we were going to get murdered and that they were random strangers, and they were like, you're going to be okay? And we were like, we'll be fine, it's okay. We went out, we had the most amazing 2 weeks. It was just extraordinarily wonderful. And they came back to see us this October half term and stayed with us in Whitney, and we went into the Blanket Museum. And it's fascinating because Mark, her husband, is from Nova Scotia, and they know all about the Hudson Bay. And we spent about 2 hours in there, and she was speaking to the lady behind. It's I don't know what her name is, but the normal woman who works in the Blanket Museum. And they got chatting. It was because obviously the Hudson Bay Company has just closed down, and they were talking and they wandered around. And it was just like, that was just wonderful as well, to bring people who we'd randomly met on our travels, who we just have become the most close, and they met my mum and dad while they were here, like, we've become the closest friends with, but to bring them to Whitney, and Robin bought me a Whitney blanket as a thank you for having them and everything, but just, and for them to be able to see the photographs of the States and Canada and all, and the trading that was going on between this little tiny town in Oxfordshire and the other side of the world, I just don't know why we're not making more of it. I feel like we should be shouting about these things, and it should be such an amazing part of the history of this area. I found out as well, so I haven't been up there yet. We've got English Heritage membership. It's not part of, like, you'd have to use it. Up at Minster Lovell, so obviously as a Tudor historian, I didn't realise that Lovell was the name of the local lord, and that lord was one of Richard III's closest. I was like, what is the... And Mama just found out recently, one of my ancestors actually fought at the Battle of Bosworth and was one of Richard's also closest, was a knight for Richard. He was 60 at the battle. He was killed in the battle. And we were talking about, imagine if Richard had won the battle and he'd survived, maybe I might have some inherited land or wealth somewhere that would have come down. And I was like, who would even... all of these tiny little things that you find out about area. And I love this. Everywhere we've been in the world, I always find out the most tiniest, extraordinary historical facts. Why are we not making more? Why are we not shouting and talking about this and getting people there to go and see this history and experience it? That frustrates me. And if I could do something to, Mark kept saying to me, you need to set up like a historical company and take people around and tour people and do, and I was like, I would, but I don't know where to start. And that's the tricky thing, because it would just, it would be my absolute joy to do something like that. So I think that Whitney has so much to offer. It is a wonderful place to live, and there are wonderful people in Whitney, without a doubt. And we feel very happy here. But I, as I say, I think for me personally, it's that ongoing frustration that the place has so much to offer. And I just wish, from a historical point of view, that we can make more of it. And how do we do that?
Okay. Well, I'm going to stop.
Is that
there.
Okay?
That's a good question for the museum to ask itself, I think. Okay, so thank you very much.
That's okay. Is that okay? I'm sorry I got upset. I didn't think I would. I've never got upset in... I've been interviewed for multiple things, and it's never... I think at the moment with everything that's going on, there's this sort of...